America and around the world. Welcome once again to the Hour of the Time. I'm your host, William Cooper, speaking to you for Swiss America Trade. Folks, there's one commodity in this whole world that functions as money anywhere, anytime, under any conditions, with any peoples. It doesn't matter if you're standing on the corner of Wall Street in New York City, Hollywood and Vine in California, or in the jungles of Borneo. Everyone you meet recognizes the importance and the value of gold or silver, and in most instances, any other precious or rare metal that you may have in your possession. It has been fact throughout history that the only thing that has preserved or protected anyone's assets in hard times or economic collapse has been good, solid investments in precious metals, gold or silver. Specifically, gold or silver coin, which is easily recognized by the common man in the smallest denomination. And the reason we recommend the smallest denomination, folks, is that if you go to buy a loaf of bread, it's going to cost you whatever you have in your hand. Remember that. Now, we know that our economy is in trouble. We know that the country is in trouble politically. We know that no world leader has emerged from William Bill Clinton. We know that none is likely to. In fact, the entire Clinton administration appears to be doomed from the start. This does not bode well for those of us who work all our lives, who believe that we have amassed something that we can pass down to our children or our grandchildren. It doesn't look like we're going to be able to do that. The only way to protect those assets, folks, is to make sure that you have what has always protected people throughout history in times of economic hardship, and that is gold or silver in many different forms. Now, we have a sponsor, Swiss America Trade. We've checked them out thoroughly, backwards, forwards, up, down, upside down, if you will. They're people just like us. They care about this country. They care about the Constitution. They care about the Bill of Rights. I want you to call them now. They've stood behind this show when no one else would. They've made sure that we had a place to broadcast when WWCR burned to the ground. They are ready and willing to work with you to build a sound base upon which to stand in the trying times to come. Call 1-800-289-2646 and do it now. Don't procrastinate. Call 1-800-289-2646. Talk to the experts there. Ask them how they can help you to protect your assets. While you're at it, mention my name, William Cooper, and ask for the free newsletter on protecting your future. Call 1-800-289-2646 and do it now. Do it right now, folks. Don't wait until it's too late. And the longer you wait, and the lower the value of the dollar becomes, the less value your assets as a whole will retain. People who called Swiss America Trading and invested with them when they first began sponsoring this show have already realized approximately 30% on their investment. So do it now. Call 1-800-289-2646. Tell them William Cooper sent you. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. Folks, tonight I'm sitting in a beautiful, elegant suite at the Disneyland Hotel in Anaheim, California. Not because I paid for this suite, mind you, nor that I could even afford it. But after speaking at the Los Angeles Airport Hyatt Hotel at UFO Expo West, we decided to take our 3-year-old daughter, Pooh, to Disneyland because she's never been. And she's at the age now where she would really enjoy it and remember it for many, many years. So when we checked into the Disneyland Hotel, they made a mistake and gave us a room. And when we got to the room, we found out that there was no one there. It didn't look like anyone had been there until we opened the closet and found that it was full of luggage. So the Disneyland Hotel, to make up for their mistake, very kindly gave us this beautiful suite for 2 days and 2 nights while we're here. And we've invited a couple up who are old friends of ours. One member of this couple, the male member, Ron Regeer, is a researcher like I am, always digging, always reading, always looking for answers to all of the mysteries and the puzzles that tend to grab our attention and baffle us and make us scratch our head and ask why this is or this isn't. And I've asked him to be our guest tonight because in the years that he has grappled with these puzzles and these problems, he's come up with some of his own answers, and he never fails at least once a month to send me a huge package, at least 2 inches thick, of information that he has dug up since I received the preceding package. Ron, I want to welcome you to the Hour of the Time tonight, and I'd like you to introduce yourself. Who are you? What do you do? How long have you been doing this? And tell us a little bit about your efforts to get to the bottom of some of the greatest questions of our time, if you will.
Well, thank you, Bill. I really don't know where to start other than I'm a 50-year-old, frustrated American who's been relatively disgusted with the way things have gone in the last 20 years or so. Things have taken a turn for the worse, and instead of expecting my children to live a better life, I found that the odds are that they're going to be struggling just to make it through even the next few years. So what I did was I started to try to find out why and what's going on. And I met Bill, and we exchanged some ideas, but we don't get to see each other that often. And what I've found is that we've been systematically destroyed from within, and I don't know how to prove it. I know Bill's got a better handle on that. But I just feel frustrated. So to do what I could, I bought some property out of state. I live in California, and I developed my own business, and hopefully we'll have enough there to sustain us through the hard times that are coming. I'm an aerospace engineer and a campground owner, and I take a lot more pride in being a campground owner
than you do an aerospace engineer.
Yeah. We're a dying breed now.
But you've seen some tremendous accomplishments during your career as an aerospace engineer. Why don't you tell us about some of these projects and things that you've helped participate in, and some of the technology that's absolutely amazing that you've helped bring into the world.
I started working for McDonnell Douglas, this was 30 years ago, building the Saturn Apollo moon rocket. And it was just amazing, the complexity then, which at the time was really just baffling, and now is almost truly simplistic in many ways. I was fortunate to be chosen to do the design specifications for the Skylab. We called it the Orbital Workshop. It was originally designed to use the Saturn IV stage, launch it wet, reach orbit, vent out the liquid hydrogen fuel and liquid oxygen oxidizer, and then make it comfortable to live in.
You said launch it wet. What does that mean?
That means with fuel.
Okay.
And then we'd dump the fuel overboard when we got out into orbit, and then leave the vents open, which would evaporate the fuel, which was just hydrogen and oxygen, so they didn't have any caustic chemicals. And then move in the boxes of food and other equipment and sustain life for a period of time. And it turns out that we had a sufficiently good rocket from then North American, which, that we were able to launch it dry. That is, build the whole workshop on the ground and not use it for a fuel tank. And then that gave us more experimental space. So you may remember about I guess it was 20 years ago when we had the Skylab go up. And it was only able to deploy the left wing, which kind of disturbed all of us. We had two wings for solar panels for power.
Yes, that did raise quite a stink and a public uproar, and everybody had their eyes on that for a while. But really, in the complexity and all of the problems that you had in getting the Skylab up there, that seems to me to be probably one of the least worries that you had, but was the one that probably brought more public attention to what was going on than anything else. What was the final solution?
Well, we ended up deploying a bag over to keep the thermal control, since we didn't have enough power to drive the refrigeration system, and just use that for a big awning. And then shorten the lifespan of the mission, but still accomplished quite a bit. It was really our first space station. And since that time, we've had no other space station.
When did you get a feeling, Ron, that something was wrong in this country? How did that come about? I mean, here you are, an aerospace engineer working for one of the premier or premium companies, you might say, having to do with aerospace. And you've had a pretty good life. You've had a pretty secure job with that company, and if everything went as you've been told all your life, then you should have a pretty good future. What happened to make you realize that that's not really the way things work?
Well, Bill, you'd probably be surprised, because I've never even hinted at this, but I didn't think things were right when, in 1957 October, I'm not remembering the day, the Soviets launched Sputnik. And it dawned on me then that I've been lied to. That if we really were the greatest nation on Earth, that we would have launched the first satellite. Now, maybe it was a childish arrogance of youth to believe that. But that's what got me started. That if we really were the best, would have been up first. And that was apparently the goal of the whole space program, was to instill that feeling. However, it happened to be true. At least for me. That we were beat by what we had been told was a second-rate power.
And we know, scientifically, by what we know that the Soviets could do and couldn't do in as far as technology is concerned, even today, they cannot manufacture a computer microchip.
Not without copying the device from us.
So, we know that, and didn't you ever think that it was very strange that everything that the Soviets did looked like something that we had already done, or paralleled exactly what we had already done, except for maybe carrying it as far as they did, like putting a man into space. I mean, we had already done all these things. The only thing that they did is they took, and I forget what we called it, but we had this tremendous giant rocket propulsion vehicle that we had never really used, and the Soviets took and put two of these together and called it a Soyuz and started putting things into space. And didn't that bother you? I mean, didn't you begin to wonder how in the world this second-rate nation, and if the truth be known, technologically they were actually third or fourth rate, how could they do this without help from those who had the technology?
Well, later on I found out, forget where the publication was, but it was a Major Jordan, who was a officer in the Army Air Corps, and I think it was North Dakota, who was responsible for checking the bill of lading on aircraft. And he kept a journal, and part of his journal was all of this defense material that was secret, top secret, that was being shipped to the Soviets across the North Pole. And I don't remember what publication that was or where I read it, but it sticks vividly in my mind that that was happening at the end of World War II and shortly thereafter. That we were supplying our military secrets to the Soviet Union.
I found this out in my own research. I found out the reason and the plan of the people who are bringing all of this about was that the world would always be on parity. And there would never, ever again be any major wars unless they planned them. In other words, everybody would be at a standoff. And that a lot of small wars would be fought in order to keep the public's attention deviated from what the real world was really like and what was really going on, to deplete specific populations, and to extract from the public of all countries of the world vast amounts of money in order to prepare the technology that would rule these people in the future New World Order. And part of this was the guise of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. It's absolutely unbelievable that during all of that time that the Soviet Union and the United States were supposed enemies, that we never fought each other, not even once. But we had all these wars by surrogate. In other words,
you're right.
We were always supposedly fighting the Soviet Union, but it was always being done in some poor, innocent little third world country who really didn't want anything to do with any of it to begin with.
I think the psychological term now with the good psycho battle we have is let's you and him fight.
That's right. So you had those suspicions early on, and
One of the things I did was I took Russian in high school because I was the optimist who believed that the Russians would be our enemies. People said the pessimists studied Chinese. I don't know if that's still true or not. They keep telling us everybody's our friend now. But to just comment on what you were saying about the Soviet technology, I found out the Russian word for truck is truck. Yet they claim to have invented it.
Well, we know that the largest truck manufacturing plant in the Soviet Union, which not only manufactures trucks but tanks, is the Kama River facility, which was actually pushed, promoted, whatever you want to say, by William Casey when he was the head of the... I forgot the name of the agency. Anyway, he was the head of the agency that's supposed to promote trade between the United States and the rest.
Is that the Agency for International Development?
That's right, Agency for International Development. William Casey was the head of that agency. He promoted, he rounded up the financing for the Kama River truck factory in the Soviet Union. And all of the trucks and most of the tanks that exist now in the Soviet Army, or what used to be the Soviet Army, which is now a whole bunch of different armies, but strangely enough, still the command structure is still in place. They are not disarming. They have not disbanded anything. They have not dismantled any nuclear weapons. They have not dismantled any missiles. There has not been any chaos. When the Soviet Union fell apart, as far as the armed forces were concerned, because to tell you the truth, the Soviet Union, as far as the armed forces are concerned, is still intact completely and has not fallen apart at all. But all of their trucks, heavy rolling stock equipment and tanks are now built at the largest manufacturing plant in the world for trucks and heavy rolling stock equipment, which is the Kama River plant. And William Casey went on to be the head of the Central Intelligence Agency and ended up dying at a crucial moment when he was being subpoenaed to testify in front of Congress about the Iran-Contra affair. And many of us who come from the intelligence community believe that rather than go into Congress and tell the truth, that he chose to commit suicide. And now, I'm not saying that that's what he did. That's totally not the way the record reflects. But let me say from experience that those of us who have been in intelligence for a good portion of our lives feel wholeheartedly, 100%, that William Casey gave up the ghost rather than go in to sit down at the table in front of the Congressional Investigating Committee. And as his wife has publicly stated, if he had done so, he would have told the truth, which tells me he either committed suicide or somebody killed him to prevent that from happening. He was a Knight of Malta. We have reason to believe he may have been a Knight Templar. He was, in fact, he had to have been a Knight Templar because while Bill Donovan said on many instances, and there's been many things written about the original Office of Strategic Services, or the OSS, from which the entire umbrella of national security and the intelligence community originally sprang, would not take anyone, and no one existed in the OSS who was not a Knights Templar. This is on public record. So, since we know that William Casey was a member of the OSS, he had to have been a Knights Templar, and we know also from the membership rolls that he was a member of the Knights of Malta. You haven't?
No, I never knew that.
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that.
But you see, here we have complicity at the highest levels of the intelligence community to create a factory in the Soviet Union, which rolled out the largest numbers of trucks and tanks of any factory built upon the face of this earth. In fact, statistics confirm that the Common River Truck Factory could actually manufacture more trucks and tanks in 1 year's period of time than all the manufacturing capability of the United States of America for rolling stock manufacturing.
Where did the financing come from?
The financing came from the citizens of the United States of America and from grants and loans provided by the United States government for the Agency for International Development. And the American people, by and large, don't know this. I wrote about it in my book, Behold a Pale Horse. Other people have written about it in their books that they wrote, other people who came out of the intelligence community and knew about this and understood the importance of it. But by and large, I would say that 99.9% of all Americans never heard of it, don't know anything about it. And at that time, in the height of the Cold War, when this occurred, it's tantamount to treason.
Was that the plant that went under the guise of Fiat Motors in Italy?
I think Fiat had something to do with it initially, but it never really went under the guise of anything. I mean, it was what it was.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe that was the cover that they were using for the initial development. It's fuzzy.
You've had some experience with the intelligence community in your work.
You mean the four security investigations and four fingerprintings in 1 year?
Sure. Tell us about that.
This was, I guess about 4 years ago. I had received, along with Lee Graham, copies of the MJ-12 papers and copies of the code name and code word and proper numerical designation for the stealth fighter. We'd all gone along thinking it was the F-19.
And that was long before anyone should have known anything about it.
That's correct.
But for the benefit of our listeners who may not know, they all know what the stealth fighter is, right, but they may not know anything about the MJ-12 documents. What were those?
Those were a group of, I think it was 9 sheets of paper, ostensibly prepared by the director of the CIA, Admiral Helen Cotter, to brief the President-elect Dwight David Eisenhower on the crash, subsequent recovery, and disposition of the remains of a UFO that crashed in New Mexico.
Which was purported to have contained extraterrestrial bodily remains.
Correct.
Biological matter and technology way beyond what we were capable of producing at that time.
And because of that, Truman was ostensibly prepared an executive order that doesn't fit any known sequence of executive order numbering systems, which is simply the date, and formed this committee to investigate this phenomenon. And we had none of the documentation supporting it, just the original briefing document.
And where did these things come from?
Well, it's a convoluted story. We got them from Bill Moore, who supposedly got them in a, get this folks, plain brown paper wrapper from Albuquerque, New Mexico, although we didn't find that out because he wouldn't stay for about 4 years.
Isn't it funny that it began and ended in Albuquerque, New Mexico?
Yeah, it's another life's coincidence.
Supposedly was sent to him from Albuquerque, New Mexico, actually to Jamie Chandray, isn't that
correct?
That's correct. Jamie Chandray is a nefarious so-called Hollywood producer, which in Hollywood, depending upon whose name comes up when you say producer, really depends upon what that word producer means. But Jamie Chandray has had a past history which is shaded by all kinds of things that bring up to mind Cloak and Dagger, films that sometimes you wonder why these things were produced and who they were aimed at. And but anyway, here's Jamie Chandra, a Hollywood producer, mixed up with a guy named William Moore, who used to be a school teacher where?
Minnesota.
In Minnesota. And all of a sudden, he's there in the Hollywood Burbank area. And somebody else is mixed in with this.
Stanton Friedman.
Stanton T. Friedman, who is billed as a nuclear physicist, but hasn't done any work in nuclear physics in over 20 years, and has only a bachelor's degree. Now, how does all this fit together?
I don't think it does.
I don't think it does either. But anyway, this is where it came from.
All right.
Supposedly, Jamie Chandra got this
right. It was a
undeveloped film.
And before he developed it, he had some, I guess you'd have to say, foreknowledge that it must be important. So before getting it processed, he calls Bill Moore. Bill Moore then believes it must be terribly important, so they take it down to and process it themselves.
I wonder how they knew it was exposed.
I have not the slightest idea.
In other words, if you get a roll of film in the mail, is it exposed or is it not exposed? How do you know it's not a friend sending you a roll of film for your camera?
I don't have friends that mail me things in double-wrapped brown paper bags, but I know what you're getting at. But then instead of sending it to a commercial photo lab, which most of us would do, they took it upon themselves to process it in their own lab.
They had a photo lab?
Ostensibly. And instead of sending it to a commercial lab, did it themselves.
So, here are some people that have no expertise in photography. They have no degrees in photography. The closest anyone even comes to photography is Jamie Chandra, who's a motion picture producer, which, believe me, folks, has nothing to do with the processing of photographic film imagery of any kind. They decide, in their own laboratory, has anybody ever seen this laboratory besides them?
I haven't.
I've never heard of anyone who saw it besides them. In fact, until tonight, I didn't know they did it in their own laboratory. And I would have questioned, I would have asked to see that laboratory right off the bat. Where is your laboratory? How did you do this? How did you know how to process the film? If none of you have any kind of education or degrees in photography, what made you think you could even begin to process this film and come out with anything of value? And if you thought it was important, how dare you do this? You should have entrusted this to someone who knew what they were doing. But what came out of this film?
Nine sheets of paper repeated, so 18 exposures in all, which formed the exposures were the photographs of the MJ-12 document.
And the
briefing document of Admiral Hillenkoetter for President-elect Eisenhower.
And you've already described what those documents were.
All right.
So, what happened then? Now, somehow they came into your possession. Did you get these directly from William Moore? Did he send these documents?
He gave them to Lee Graham, and we got copies and essentially made photocopies and distributed them throughout many in the UFO community. Took copies down to security at our plant. Because they were marked top secret, magic eyes only.
Now, at the same time, another exact set of these documents surfaced in England that were supposedly passed to a man named Timothy Good,
who plays the violin
for the
London
Philharmonic, by a Central Intelligence Agency operative. Is that correct?
He said an American intelligence agent, if I'm remembering right.
Okay.
Which pretty well narrows it to CIA, but I don't recall him saying CIA.
Okay. I'll give him that leeway. I think I did hear him say CIA at one time, but it doesn't make any difference.
Who else is there?
That's right. And if this was leaked by undeveloped film to Jamie Chandra and given in the form of documents to Timothy Good in England at the same time, this is no accidental leak. This isn't somebody who's disgruntled with the CIA snapping some photographs and sending them off to William Moore, Jamie Chanteray, Stanton Friedman. Don't leave Stanton Friedman out because he thinks he's escaped from the implications of this, and I can assure him that he has not. But this is an indication that somebody planned this double leak at the same time, because it was leaked in two different forms to two different people halfway around the world.
And again, you and I and most of America doesn't believe in this kind of a coincidence.
That's correct. Okay, folks, we've got to take a break. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short pause. That didn't take very long. This is William Cooper speaking to you again for Swiss America Trading. You know, we're awfully lucky to have such a large and concerned listening audience. And we're even luckier to have a sponsor for this program, the Hour of the Time, the only hour that ever was or ever will be. For during this hour, you will decide your future, and thus our collective futures. A sponsor who cares as much as we all care about freedom, about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, about everyone in this world who is oppressed. They have backed this show when no one else would. They stayed with us when WWCR was burned to the ground to shut us up. They didn't bail out. They have received threats, folks. You don't know about this, but I do. They've received threats. They've received intimations. They've received phone calls. Some from people whose names you would recognize in 10 seconds flat, trying to get them to abandon the Hour of the Time. And they have not done it. So I want you to stand behind them. You see, they're in business. They're in the business of providing hard assets, some of which are non-confiscatable, non-reportable, to help you protect what you've earned, made, collected, what's valuable to you in your lifetime. All you have to do is call them and talk to them. There are experts there who will give you recommendations. But remember, folks, it's your money. They have many different investments that you can take advantage of. Some, they believe in very strongly. If you don't believe in those investments, tell them, no, I don't want that. I want this, or I want that, or I want to hear about something else. You have to take charge. It's your money. Don't be bashful. Could you imagine me calling somebody and saying, hey, I've worked all my life, and I've collected $15,000, and I want to put that $15,000 somewhere to protect it. And somebody tells me that I should buy XXX, and I don't believe in XXX? Do you think that I'm going to accept what they tell me and just buy XXX? No. I'm going to say, I don't want XXX, but I understand you have YYY. Can you tell me about YYY? And if YYY is attractive to me, I'll buy it. But I want to explore all different things. I want to hear from different people what it is that I'm doing, what the potential is for protecting my assets, or for any possible gain in the future. I want to know these things. You should take charge always. It's your money, but you should call Swiss America Trading, folks. They want to help you. They care about you. They care about this country, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, and freedom for the world. And they care about and they back this show, The Hour of the Time, which, I might add, is the only place in the world where you can still hear the truth. The only place. Uncluttered, uncontradicted. If we make a mistake, we're the first ones to tell you that we made a mistake. But you won't hear us make a statement on this show and then next week contradict it. It doesn't happen here. We only give you what we believe in. We're not fly-by-night. We're not the popes of pablum. You can hear that on other shows and other radio stations, other frequencies, and other media. Call Swiss America Trading tonight, 1-800-289-2646. They bring you the hour of the time, and that warrants your loyalty, your attention, and your business. 1-800-289-2646. Do it right now. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait until it's too late, folks. You've already lost money. If you've been watching the financial news, you know that the dollar is not worth what it used to be. It's not worth what it was when Swiss America Trading began sponsoring this show. Those who took advantage of the investments with Swiss America Trading have already realized at least a 30% increase in the value of their assets as compared to the dollar. Which means if you didn't do it, you've lost 30%, folks. Call 1-800-289-2646 and do it right now. That's 1-800-289-2646. Mention my name, William Cooper, and ask for the newsletter on protecting your future. Also, ask folks, ask now for the pamphlet, the book put out by Harry Figge, and you'll get that also. Call now, 1-800-289-2646. Do it now. You'll be glad that you did. Now let's get back to our special guest tonight, Ron Regeer. We were talking about these supposedly top secret documents that were leaked by this research team of Stanton T. Friedman, William Moore, and Jamie Chanderay, three nefarious characters who were highly respected in the research arena until later when all of this fell apart. But let's continue now where these papers were leaked or given to or passed to you, Ron, and another friend of yours, Lee Graham.
That's correct.
At your place of employment.
That's correct. And we took copies to security because they're marked top secret. And
they were marked top secret, the copies that they gave to you.
Top secret, magic eyes only.
So you took them directly to your security personnel, which was the right thing to do. Didn't happen.
Believe it or not, they ran a copy on an unclassified machine.
The security people?
The security people did. But they make the rules. They can break the rules. They ran a copy for themselves and said they'd look into it, gave us back the copies, and we went on our way, sent them out amongst the different people in the community to see what the response was. One of the things we heard was a friend of ours had another friend who had worked in the Air Force at a listening station in Sinop, Turkey. And at that listening station, whenever they were there to track the launch of Soviet missiles using the long-range radars there across the Black Sea.
Uh-huh.
And what they did was, if they got a radar return that didn't correlate to any known air traffic or Soviet traffic, they would send those tapes back to a group in Texas called the MJ-12 group. So we were the belief that this was maybe a valid tie-in. So we wanted to make sure this individual in San Diego got a copy of these documents.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons we sent them out. We spent, well, I would say $100 easily on postage, shipping them through any place you could think of, leaving copies at air bases, at air shows with the guards, about any place you can think of. Lawrence Livermore Lab, Edwards Air Force Base during the big air show. Really shake up an AP two-striper if you hand him a top secret document and say, is this legitimate? You get all kinds of reactions.
Well, of course. You're lucky you weren't all rounded up and thrown in the hoosegow while somebody figured out what you had and why you had it and whether or not it really was top.
Well, they did give us the Air Force equivalent. Don't leave town before sundown.
What happened? Tell us about that.
Well, in every instance, they would take the documents, rush off, and then pretty soon a harried-looking lieutenant would step up and ask us where we got them.
Where do all these lieutenants come from?
They must have a special school. They stamp them out like gingerbread cookies. And would tell the whole story, and they'd take copies, seize the copies, and that we'd be free to go, which is what we wanted to do, was get them in the hands of someone who could either refute or verify them.
Mm-hmm.
Sent copies to the NSA, the NSC, FBI, CIA.
But what's interesting is nobody ever did refute them.
Up until last month.
And nobody ever did verify them.
That's right. Neither one.
And nobody ever arrested anybody.
That's right.
Now they did investigate people.
We were investigated because of stealth fire.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the straight skinny on that, but that was somewhat foolish because another friend of mine, another investigator, a researcher, whatever you want to call him, had found out that they were based at Tonopah, up in the Nevada desert. And to make it easy on him, he bought some reflectors, nice little 4-inch truck reflectors, mm-hmm. duct taped them to the rocks, so he could drive out across the desert at night with just his parking lights on, with the reflection of these reflectors, and park at the edge of the airstrip and watch the F-117s do night operations, which was the only time they flew them. And while the various senators were denouncing the existence of the stealth fighter, I was writing letters saying, if you don't believe it, you go out here and you turn left at the rockets that have been shot up with shotgun shells outside of Tonopah, follow the reflectors to the fence, and you can watch them all you want. And it's not the F-19, it was the F-117, it was the senior trend, our senior, I'm not remembering now, it's been several years, but, and it was the Nighthawk.
Uh-huh.
And for that, we were brought in and investigated by the Defense Investigative Service.
They say we, who's we?
Lee Graham and I.
Now, Lee Graham told me on the telephone one time that he was investigated and brought in and sat down and shown the documents that he had been passing out from William Moore, and was grilled about these MJ-12 documents. Is that correct?
Yes, we both were.
And so you told them where you got them?
We told them the truth.
And what happened then?
Absolutely nothing with me. They let me go and let Lee go. And they had him sign an affidavit. And I wouldn't sign any affidavit. And he was sworn to secrecy, and I could say anything I wanted to.
But the kicker is that they never investigated the source of these
never once,
which was Jamie Chanteray, Stanton T. Friedman, and William Moore.
As a matter of fact, we asked him, you know, if you don't believe us, ask him. Here's his phone number. Here's his address.
Uh-huh.
And you're more than welcome to. Never once did they go ask him.
So what ultimately came of all of this? Now, I understand that they were running the New York Times.
Yeah, that ultimately last month, we received a letter, Lee received it, from a Colonel Weaver. And the Colonel Weaver had stamped them with about 4 different stamps, none of which I've ever seen in any government office before.
What did the stamps say?
Fraudulent document, not an Air Force, not an official Air Force document. It's a
well, it may not have been an official Air Force document.
Then he's in violation.
These are silly things that the government plays.
But if it is, he's in violation of the DOD standard for downgrading documents, because only the originating agency is allowed to do that.
Well, that's correct, but that's another game they play also with disinformation. And they do these kinds of things to make people believe that this stuff is genuine. But, and you're absolutely right, unless the Air Force was the originating agency, if it was a top secret compartmentalized project, which it had to have been if it was real, because it said top secret / magic, MAJIC, which would have been the subcompartmentalization, he could never have downgraded and stamped them as fraudulent or anything else. But you find this kind of documentation rampant throughout the so-called field of goofology. I'm sorry, ufology. Or foolology.
Ufology.
Ufology. But people in this fraudulent field even flaunt these documents as being absolute fact, and when in reality, Not a single one of them would stand up in any court of law in the world anywhere. None of them are proof of anything. None of them are certified. You cannot track down the origin of any single document that's been leaked from any source about anything concerning flying saucers or UFOs, including the so-called documentation released under the Freedom of Information Act from the FBI, because none of it is certified. None of it. And they're all copies of original documents. None of them has been certified as to their origin, identity, or department, or initial author of those documents, or anything. Which means, in a court of law, a judge would just glance at them and throw them in the trash can.
So one of the things that's always been, out of the awareness of the American people is that intelligence communities, irrespective of some law passed by the Senate, will not ever release any documents they don't want to release.
That's correct. And one of the things that I know through my stint in the Office of Naval Intelligence is that there are no accidental leaks. There are no ex-CIA employees who write books exposing the agency. If an ex-employee writes a book exposing the agency, that was his mission. And it has a set purpose. All leaks that I have ever discovered, and this is right out of the intelligence training manual, so to speak, are intentional. They're never accidental. If they are accidental, there's an immediate counterintelligence operation put into place to negate whatever damage that could have done. But the law is very plain in what it states, and it states that no one who has ever participated in any level of an intelligence operation can ever go out and talk about it without serious repercussions.
So intelligence agents are about like pilots. There's old ones and there's bold ones, but there's no old bold ones.
That's right. And there's no ex-intelligence agents. It's not that way. Now, we know that there are a lot of books supposedly written, Philip Agee, or Agee, however you want to pronounce his name, wrote one of the first books supposedly revealing the inner operations of the CIA. Now, the CIA then branded him as a communist. Philip Agee was then able to mix with the far left and the communists and bring more intelligence into the Central Intelligence Agency than anyone had ever been done before, because they hailed him as a hero. Now, he wasn't able to penetrate the KGB, because the KGB is smarter than that. They're playing the same game, and they know what's going on. But as far as left-wing and subversive elements that existed here in the United States, I mean, he was just welcomed with open arms. And at that time, that's exactly what they wanted. That was the time when there was a lot of civil unrest in this country. That was the time when the students were coming up in arms. That was the times when they had the Chicago riots, when they had Kent State, when the military and the government agencies were so fearful of an internal uprising against the Vietnam War that they were actually making plans to suspend the United States Constitution to bring the population under control. And everybody bought this story of Philip Agee writing this book exposing the CIA, when the truth is that he didn't expose anything. I saw something on TV here recently with Victor Marchetti and Daniel Sheehan.
Oh, yes.
And a few of the other assorted and sundry usual suspects. If they had been present in Humphrey Bogart's Casablanca, they would have been the usual suspects that would have been rounded up. Here's Victor Marchetti, the ex-head of the operational division of the CIA. The Deputy Chief of Operations, I believe, was his title, sitting there talking about the Kennedy assassination, blaming it on the Central Intelligence Agency. This doesn't happen. He also wrote a paragraph somewhere, or said this in a speech, which was then written down and promulgated all over the place, that the CIA knew all about flying saucers and extraterrestrials, and that they couldn't tell the public because the public would panic. These things are planted. He's not telling us the truth. He's telling us what the CIA wants the public to hear, and nothing else. Because he is considered to be an officer. And if he had said these things against policy, if he was not supposed to say these things, he would have been reactivated and sent to Siberia, or the North Pole, or the South Pole, or Thule, Greenland, or someplace where they could have kept him quiet, or they could have court-martialed him and just locked him up for 5 million years. Now, I know this, and you know this, and everybody else connected with the defense industrial establishment or the military and the intelligence community knows this, but the vast herd of American sheeple don't know these things.
I think they don't want to know. It's more than they don't know because they don't want to take the time. They don't want to look.
But do you think that they prefer to sit there and listen to these people and believe what they're saying is the truth rather than understand that they're being used by these people?
Well, it takes work to go out and find the truth. It's not something that's dumped in your lap.
Well, that's true. We know that.
Yeah.
How many years have we been looking for the truth, and we know that it's elusive at best, very difficult to find, but we know what the rewards are, don't we?
Yeah, but most of the people would just prefer to have a cold six-pack of beer and a good football game on, and they're happy.
Well,
and I,
to tell you the truth, I wouldn't mind that myself if I knew that nothing bad would ever come of that.
But if my grandchildren could enjoy the same thing.
That's right. What I know is that if I were to fall into that complacency and take on that kind of luxurious life, and it is a luxury that none of us can afford, that the future would be very, very bad indeed for all of us. And luckily, there are enough of us who are not doing that we can sound the alarm for those who are. If they'll just get up off their butts and look around, they'll see that they should not be doing that. Tell us some of the things that you've discovered in your search.
They're lying to us about AIDS. AIDS was created in a laboratory. It's not strictly a homosexual disease. It's not strictly any disease other than one of opportunism. It was spread deliberately, and the cure is being withheld deliberately until what our government considers to be undesirable factions are sufficiently thinned.
Now, where did you find this out? Because immediately people out there are going to say, Bill told him to say this.
No, I wrote Freedom of Information Act requests and other requests to different government agencies shortly after the Surgeon General spread his pamphlet of lies to every household in the United States. I didn't believe it. So I wrote the Centers for Disease Control. I talked with physicians. I checked, and turns out the entire pamphlet was full of lies. Further work revealed that the AIDS virus is somewhat smaller than the malaria virus and is easily transmitted by mosquitoes or bed bugs. That it's not a fragile virus. It'll live for 7-8 days, maybe even as long as 2 weeks on a porcelain surface, dry, to be completely reactivated again as soon as it's moist.
But you found all this because you looked.
That's it. I just looked. It took me maybe 8 hours. But it's 8 hours well spent and spread over a couple of weeks.
And what else have you found? What have you found on other subjects and other...
Let's see. I guess to me the most surprising was that at one time all of the land in the United States was called allodial title, or a title of allodium.
Oh, yes.
Meaning
I had no idea you were talking about this, but I'm glad that you are. Go ahead.
Meaning that with a title of allodium, you owe nothing to anyone. It's yours.
And that land can't even be taxed.
Can't be taken for taxes. I guess the nearest something you all might remember is watching, I think it's Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and you'll see the Lord Umpty Ump and his large estate, and he has to have house guests and rent it out because he can't afford his taxes. And have you ever wondered why the crown didn't come in and take his property like they do here? They can't. He has title of Elodian. Every square inch of this country used to be allodial title. And now it's fee simple. And what does fee simple mean? Simply in faith. Faith in who? The same people who stole it from you.
And that's why you have a warrant deed instead of an allodial or a patent deed. And all a warrant deed means is that it warrants that there is a deed, but you don't have it. And when you pay your property taxes, you're paying actually a rental fee to the true owner, which is the state. And if you fail to make your property tax or rental payment, they can come and take the land away from you. Just as if you're renting a house from the true owner and you don't make that rental payment, they can come and evict you out onto the street. And all of this happened because of something that happened back in the 1930s that we don't have to get time to get into, but maybe it'll spark your curiosity enough that you'll get up off your little tush and go find out for yourself what happened in the 1930s that brought all this about. It's the same with your car, folks. Haven't you ever wondered why when you pay off your car, you don't get a title? You get a certificate of title. A certificate of title merely certifies that a title exists, but you don't have it. And every time you go down and pay the registration on your car, you're actually paying a rental fee to operate that car. And the first time you fail to make that payment, they can come and take your car. The true owner, that is. So, anyway, go ahead. Tell us some more of these fascinating
things. Well, I'll continue. I can tell you how to get your own car. What you do is, in California, you can take your vehicle, or your supposed vehicle, to a wrecking yard, make sure that you trust the guy, and declare it a wreck. He will send the pink slip to Sacramento. Sacramento will stamp it for salvage use. Then you buy it from the wrecking yard owner, paying him gold and silver coin, and it's yours.
And then you don't have to register?
You can't register.
That's absolutely right. You can't. But it belongs to you.
That's it.
And under the Constitution, if it belongs to you 100% totally, you're not required to register, are you?
That's correct.
And you can travel with that car anywhere you want, as long as you're not a driver. You're a traveler.
And as long as you don't have insurance.
That's correct.
Surprised you again, didn't I, Bill?
No, you didn't, because you used to surprise me until I realized that that you're an extremely intelligent man and have really done an awful lot of research, and I never take that for granted about anybody, because I found that most people in this country are not people at all, they're sheeple. They're not really, they may have the capability of intelligence or thinking, but they very seldom use that intelligence, and they never do any thinking. Most Americans have never had an original thought in their entire life, except for steady listeners to this show. They wouldn't be listening to this show if they were not thinking individuals. People who join my organization, CADI, Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence, are thinkers, are doers. They're not people who sit back and watch things happen. These are people who make things happen. But you have to understand that in this country, less than 10% of the total population have a shortwave radio and could even possibly listen to this show. And there, you don't hear anything like you hear on this program on any other media in this country. So most people out there don't have the slightest clue as to what's going on.
If Daniel Rather doesn't tell it to him at 7 o'clock, it isn't true. You know that.
That's right. And time's up. Thank you for being our special guest tonight, Ron Regeer, and hope to have you back again maybe tomorrow night or some other time. Good night, folks. And as usual, God bless you all.